Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Good to you, Johnny. It's Tuesday, the 13th of June, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Mark Langdon and Paul Curry on Kylian Mbappe's annual transfer saga. Plus, we're continuing our build-up to Ireland's big qualifier in Greece.
We're also going to start our build-up to the European Games, which begin in Krakow in 8 days' time, with Team Ireland's chef de mission Gavin Noble. In tennis, we're going to get around to speaking to Conor Nyland about Novak Djokovic's career high, while in golf, John McHenry will set us up for this week's US Open.
If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome along. Paul Curry is with us in the studio. How are you, Paul?
I'm very good, Marie. Very good indeed.
We're at the transfer saga stage of the summer.
It has begun, hasn't it? I liked your annual Mbappe transfer saga.
That was our producer Ronan's handiwork, not mine. Can't take credit for that.
But this time it is pounds, shillings and pence. So what's going to happen, Paul Curry?
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting, Ruby. Mbappe is obviously not taking PSG up on the option of a third year at the Parc des Princes. So it's going to be really interesting. They are coming out and saying that they don't want to let Mbappe go on a free transfer in 12 months' time. And you can fully understand that they might want to cash in. But I guess the question is, who can afford him? And really, if you're looking around Europe and thinking about the types of teams that might be able to broker a deal from, for me, it only really looks like Real Madrid. And I know Man City are maybe financially capable of getting them in the door, but with all the questions that are lingering over their financial fair play, I'm not sure that's an avenue that's really going to be open. And take into consideration that Benzema has left Real Madrid, that number nine position has opened up. And I think Real Madrid will still fancy Mbappe. There's a lot of rumours that Perez was really unhappy that he turned them down, not once but twice, and maybe that was going to be the reason that they wouldn't get him in the door. But I don't think they would have prepared for Benzema leaving to Saudi Arabia, and I think that is really the only avenue that Mbappe could go down. The only thing that I'll throw in on top of that is he might be using this to his advantage. Like, don't forget, the benchmark for contracts has completely changed in the last couple of weeks with what is on offer in Saudi Arabia. Like, we haven't seen the likes of the Kante contract, the Ronaldo contract, the Benzema contract. And maybe he's looking and thinking, well, what was offered to me 12 months was a really good deal, but what was a top contract 12 months ago is completely different to what
and
is
Messi
happened.
Is gone now, so he is the biggest star in PSG. Well, he's definitely a bigger star than Neymar, I reckon, anyway. Mark Langdon joins us now. Mark, what's your take on it?
I don't think it's about money for Mbappe. I don't think he's using this as leverage to get PSG to spend sort of more on him. There was talk that they were even prepared, the Qatari owners were even prepared to offer him equity as well. And, you know, that would have probably eclipsed anything he could get, even sort of at Real Madrid. I think this is purely a move about sporting ambition. He's frustrated with the way that the team's been set up in Paris for quite some time. He did stay, and he has got split loyalties because he is a Paris Saint-Germain supporter. And I think in an ideal world, he would have sort of won the Champions League with PSG. But the team just continually falls apart. Now, he is part of that team. And so I suppose in some respects, he has to take a part responsibility for it. But I think this is all about sporting ambition and just his frustrations with the fact that Paris Saint-Germain have once again, you know, almost starting again. They're going to get a new manager, presumably Julian Nagelsmann. And just everything they've tried hasn't worked out. And, you know, you can talk about Man City and the money that they've spent and the money that they've got. But Paris Saint-Germain have got all of that money as well and all of that sort of clout in terms of the financial sort of, you know, in terms of who they can bring in. And you look at the way that Man City are run and you look at the way that PSG are run and, you know, it's worlds apart. And, I think that Mbappe's just, his patience has run out with the club that he does love and the team he supports. And he just feels like he's got more chance of winning if he goes somewhere else.
Paul, does it matter who PSG bring in? Are they ever going to be able to build a team that's going to get enough competition week in, week out to win a Champions League in the French Ligue 1?
I think what they've tried to do will probably have to change, Ruby, in the sense that they tried to subscribe to getting the biggest superstars and the best individuals into the building, and as a project that has failed. They obviously went after the trio of Mbappe, Neymar and Messi, and that just didn't work. Like,
from a pure marketing point of view, though, it did work, because all you have to do is walk down any street in any country of a big city and towns and villages, and everyone's wearing PSG kits.
Yeah, commercially it probably has, but I think the Qataris, when they went into PSG, as with Man City and Abu Dhabi, it was all about winning the Champions League, and those three players were brought in to win the Champions League, and they just didn't produce. They got to one final, wasn't it, when they played Bayern Munich in that COVID stage, but other than that, particularly since Messi's been there, they have underperformed in the Champions League. And if we're talking about how they're going to have to rectify that, they're going to have to become more of a team unit. Messi has already gone out the door. You would suspect that Neymar's probably within the last 12 months of his tenure at PSG. They need to, I guess, strategically, like Marcus mentioned it there about how Man City have gone, they need to recruit based on the positions and based on what it is they're trying to do to win football matches. They also need to get a strong character in there to manage that side, probably somebody with European experience of going deep into European competitions. But it's not all about spending money, it's about getting the right people into the building, and PSG have not done that over the last kind of 24-36 months. And there's probably a case that they're not tested enough in the French League. Like, Mbappe must be bored of playing those teams. Like, they're so much better. They waltz to the Ligue 1 every season, and I'm not sure they're tested week in, week out enough to then switch it on when they get into the top European competitions.
Mark, does this, or will this, Kylian Mbappe potential move to Real Madrid have an impact on where Harry Kane ends up?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's pretty sort of, yeah, Spurs haven't made an official statement, but I think in all their briefings, it's going to take an astronomical bid for them to sell to another Premier League team. Maybe Real Madrid would have been different. But if Mbappe ends up at Real Madrid, then obviously they're not going to need Harry Kane. Now, maybe if Paris Saint-Germain lose Mbappe and they lose Messi and, you know, potentially Neymar as well, that they're hoping that maybe one of the Saudi Arabian clubs comes in for him, then that would open up 1, 2, 3 spots in sort of the PSG team. Would Harry Kane want to play for Paris Saint-Germain? It would offer him a chance of some easy trophies, but, you know, does winning the league with PSG count for that much at the end of his career? I you know, you'd have to speak to him about that. I'm not sure that move is necessarily the one that he would have dreamt of. Real Madrid is probably different. So the one thing I've got against maybe Mbappe going to Real Madrid is just that Mbappe has time and time again said he wants to play on the left wing. He feels that is his best position, or up front with another striker. Real Madrid, of course, have got Vinicius on the left wing and they've got Rodrigo on the right wing. He isn't Benzema. He doesn't play in that Benzema role. Now, he's a brilliant forward, but that wouldn't be his strength. So as Mbappe decided that he wants to get out of Paris Saint-Germain so much that he is prepared to play as that central forward, or would Real Madrid consider maybe moving Vinicius into the middle and playing Mbappe wide? I'm not sure. So that's the only sort of doubt I've got, really, as to whether Mbappe ends up at Real Madrid now, because I think they are probably prepared to pay 180, 200 million euros. They've saved a huge amount in wages with Benzema and Hazard and Asensio leaving. So they have, I think they've got the capabilities to pull off this transfer, but that from just a pure footballing point of view, just how Mbappe fits in and how different he is to Benzema, it would be a headache, I would have thought, for Carlo Ancelotti. One that he'll enjoy doing and trying to solve, but a headache nonetheless.
This will be the transfer that has that domino effect. Depending on where Mbappe goes, will then have the domino effect on Harry Kane and who Tottenham bring in or who Manchester United go after, because Kane could then end up at Manchester United if he doesn't end up at Madrid. There'll be a huge domino effect off this.
Is there other options for Mbappe, or is Real Madrid the only realistic one?
I don't think so anyway, personally. I don't think there's enough teams in the Premier League who could broker that deal. Don't forget, Liverpool said they couldn't broker the Jude Bellingham deal. So there's no chance, if they can't get Bellingham done, they're not going to be able to get Mbappe done.
No, I suppose, you know, if Manchester United do get sold and they've got new owners that want to make this, you know, huge statement to the rest of the world of, You know, we're here and we want to be the, you know, Man City have won the treble, but, you know, we're going to become sort of, you know, the new kings of Europe. Then that might be the only team I would have thought, because, you know, Man City have got the funds, but they've also got Haaland. So it wouldn't make, you know, much sense for them. I wouldn't have thought to even sort of think about Mbappe. So I would say United are a long shot, but if you wanted to throw another team in there, you know, you need a lot to happen. You need the deal to go through on the takeover. You need, you know, the new owners to want to spend that type of money. You need Mbappe to wait for the owners to sort of get in, or, you know, all of their things into play. So I would say Real Madrid is the most logical option at the moment. I don't see kind of, you know, Bayern Munich can't afford him. Barcelona, I've already got Lewandowski. So it would feel like Real Madrid would be the strong favourites.
Paul, have Chelsea offloaded some of those extra players that they have that they don't even put in their squad, maybe?
Listen, there's a fire sale at Chelsea trying to get players. Pochettino worked with him on Paris Saint-Germain. I just don't see it happening. I think it's either stay at Paris Saint-Germain for another 12 months or he'll end up at Madrid.
Mark, any developments on the Manchester United sale?
Well, I mean, only the fact that the Qatari bid seems to be kind of the one that's, I suppose, leading, if you like. So it's hard to say. I mean, it's been done in such secrecy. And, you know, does that mean the Glazers would completely depart, or, you know, there was talk of them trying to still hang around? What I do think is that it's really going to impact on Erik ten Hag's sort of summer spending plans if it's not done soon, because, you know, you really don't know what you're dealing with at the moment with Manchester United. They could become as rich as Manchester City potentially, or, you know, Paris Saint-Germain, or it could be under the Glazers as it was, where that they are making some significant signings, but then they're also bringing in Weghorst because they're not able to, you know, to keep on going that extra mile. So it sounds like the Qatari bid is sort of the preferred one, but I'm not sure how close we are to completion of that.
So the rumours then, Mark, or the murmurings even about Jason Mason Mount and David Raya, they'll probably be on ice until something happens with that deal.
Yeah, I mean, I would have thought that sort of, you know, Mason Mount is obviously one that United want, and it's probably affordable no matter who's in charge. You know, United did sign Casemiro last summer. You know, before that, it was Varane. So they, even under the Glazers, they have been able, and Sancho would be another one, they have been able to make, you know, a significant signing. Obviously, you know, Mbappe, even discounting the wages, would be, you know, more than double what Mason Mount would be. I think David Raya is an interesting one. Spurs also in the market for a goalkeeper, and Raya's distribution sort of made him one of the best in the Premier League from that standpoint. And I think United definitely need a new goalkeeper. I was at Wembley for the FA Cup final, and the amount of times that De Gea made small mistakes with his kicking that just stopped Ten Hag playing from the way that he would really want to. You saw it in the Champions League final. Onana for Inter was influential. He was the goalkeeper, but he was able to set attacks and sort of, you know, you're able to keep the ball by having a goalkeeper that can play that way. So I definitely think United need a new goalkeeper. I don't think anybody wants to pay $40 million, though, for David Raya. He's got 1 year left on his contract. Brentford have already signed a replacement for him. So you would imagine that price would come down rather than, you know, reach that full $40 million. And that would be another one that where I think if you're a United fan, you'd hope you'd be able to, you know, get Raya if that's who you want, without the ownership being that important, really, in terms of it. I'm thinking more about an Mbappe style signing, really, would be potentially what you're looking at with the new owners if they really wanted to make a statement.
Paul, who would want to sign Declan Rice from West Ham for what is reportedly a figure of $100 million?
I'm sure there's a lot of teams who would like to get him into the building anyway. I think he's been superb, Marie, in the last 12 months at West Ham. It looks nailed on that Arsenal are kind of that first choice. It just seems that there's a bit of a difference in the valuation of what Arsenal are wanting to pay and what West Ham want to let him go. But I would say that is probably the most likely avenue for Declan Rice to go down. If not Arsenal, potentially Chelsea, if Chelsea could make financial sense for them. But I think naturally enough, Declan Rice would fit into that Arsenal team. I think when Thomas Partey was out and injured, we saw the gap that was there, and they certainly need more bodies in the middle of the pitch. A lot of that might depend then on what happens Saicedo at Brighton. It seems like Chelsea and Arsenal are both in for him as well. So I would imagine that if Declan Rice was to go to Arsenal, Chelsea would get Caicedo, and vice versa. If Caicedo was to end up at Chelsea, Declan Rice would end up at Arsenal. But I think both of those would be a good move for Declan Rice. He wants to play in kind of that top four, top six. He wants to play on a manager and a team who's going to have the majority of the possession of the ball, and that would probably really ramp up his game. So I see that as being the natural move for him. He obviously has ties with Chelsea, haven't been there as a young lad, but whether or not they can make that financial sense, I'm not too sure. But I would fully expect, if I was to pick one club, Marie, that would be Arsenal.
So Arsenal for Declan Rice. And Mark, Frankie de Jong, he didn't come to Old Trafford last year, but is he going to the Camp Nou?
I mean, Frankie de Jong has been linked away from sort of Barcelona for it just feels like forever. And, you know, he stayed there. He seems like he enjoys it. I think he's on. The problem for Barcelona is that his wages are quite, if not unmanageable, certainly higher than they would have liked. It was negotiated by the previous owners who were throwing sort of money around, knowing that they weren't going to be there for the long haul. And so when you know, when the new president comes in, he looks at all the contracts that they've got. The De Jong one is probably unpalatable compared to some of the others. But I'm not sure that there's a huge market out there for De Jong anymore. It was Manchester United, wasn't it? It was getting almost boring, really, the amount of times he was linked there. But in the end, they went for Casemiro, different type of sort of midfield controller. But I would be surprised if he left Barcelona, but the wages is why I think Barcelona are almost trying to put it out there that they would be open to selling De Jong, because they would prefer it if he was off the wage bill, particularly when they've got Pedri and Gavi, you know, coming through, and two players that can absolutely play in those midfield roles already, you know. So it's one that Barcelona would do. I'm not sure that anybody's really that desperate for him, though.
Brendan Rodgers looks like he could be on the move to Celtic. He is reportedly considering various options and has held talks over a potential return to Celtic. Would this be the right move for him, do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I said on the show last week that I thought it made sense. I know Celtic fans were a little disappointed about how his previous tenure ended when he went to Leicester and kind of left them high and dry in the middle of the season. But I think this makes sense. I think if you look at the way in particular that Celtic have been playing under Postecoglou and the players that he has brought into the building, that is very much mirrored by what Brendan Rodgers tries to do. Don't forget, he knows the club. He was very successful during his previous stint and won a bucket load of trophies. So I think it makes sense. He's had a bit of a break away from the game, knows the club inside out. I think it makes a lot of logical sense to bring him back into the building and take off from where Postecoglou has left it. It's probably not the most attractive given that they might have wanted somebody fresh to come in with ideas, but I think based on what he's done previously and based on where he is in his career, I think it's a good move for Celtic.
And Mark, Silvio Berlusconi has left a big hole in Milan.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the former president died earlier on this week. I mean, he lived a very full and controversial, controversial, colourful life. Certainly, more than you know, he certainly lived his years. I think that's fair to say. You know, he was a divisive character, I think, in terms of politics. I've seen, you know, people maybe referring to him as like a Donald Trump, sort of before Donald Trump, which you can certainly understand, I think, those comparisons. In terms of football, though, he was a big part of Milan's success, what they had going under Arrigo Sacchi when they won back-to-back European Cups, a team that changed really the way that teams played football, that Sacchi team. And that there was no doubt that he was a, you know, a big part of that success in terms of the money he put in there, the backing he gave those coaches. It was at a time when Italian football was, you know, booming, and the Premier League sort of, you know, how that is now. That's what Serie A was like in the kind of 90s when Berlusconi was ruling the Rossoneri. And even more recently, he went down into Serie B with Monza. He sort of put the pieces in place there, including some financial backing that got them back up into Serie A. And, you know, there were a lot of people connected with Milan, likes of Baresi, that spoke very highly of Berlusconi. Like I say, there was some stuff outside of football that very controversial. But I think just in terms of his what he did for Milan, that won't be forgotten by their supporters.
Yeah, and the club themselves have played tribute as well to their former owner. Let's turn our attention now to the Republic of Ireland. They are playing Greece away from home on Friday. We will have an extended programme here with live commentary, so do tune in for that. The Ireland team are in Turkey preparing for this game. They've had some extra preparation ahead of this. They were in Bristol for a while, and a couple of League of Ireland players were in there as well. So Stephen Kenny seems to be leaving no stone unturned. Callum O'Dowd, the Ireland player, spoke to Tony O'Donoghue about what that extra preparation means to the team.
And I think our preparation has been very good, whether it be from starting off in Bristol for the 4 days, and then a lot of people will be saying how they've been out there for ages in Turkey, but it starts on the preparation, whether it be from getting to know the lads even more, I'd say. But just from a preparation point of view, we've been able to work on different systems, the details of, I'd say, everything from set plays to in and out of possession, from every different part of the pitch, and studying how Greece play. Obviously, they're a very good team, so we can't look over that, but yeah, definitely. We'll be looking to definitely get the win.
Would you say it's more like a club preparation rather than an international team preparation? Normally it's quite hurried, isn't it? You've got 2-3 days max.
Yeah, you could say so. It does feel quite hard when you're coming into camps. I'd say whenever it be after your game on the Saturday, you probably come in on the Sunday, but then you're not even able to get on the pitch probably until Monday, Tuesday, just from fatigue or whatever reason. So it's been really refreshing, I'd say, to come out here and have a lot of time. And it does feel like a club preparation, because we've been able to work on so many different things. But then also the downtime we've had together as well, whether it be silly things when you're discussing things off the pitch. I don't know, whether you're walking just around the hotel or just around the pool. It's just things like that, I guess, that you don't really get to do when we're back in Dublin. So yeah, it's strange but good.
Callum O'Dowd is speaking to Tony O'Donoghue this week in Turkey as they prepare for that game against Greece on Friday. Paul, just listening to him, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't he? That, like, a team that are still probably coming through that transition period under Stephen Kenny in many ways, that any bit of extra time that they get to spend together learning systems, whatever it is, will all benefit, we hope, on Friday when they go to play Greece.
Yeah, I guess the proof will be in the pudding when we take to the pitch on Friday against Greece, and we'll see how well they have prepared. But this goes back to 12 months ago, Marie, when we played Armenia away, and maybe the squad and the management felt a bit undercooked because we ended up losing that game 1-0 away from home, and obviously wanted to tidy up this time round and get an extra few sessions in the legs of the players. Don't forget as well that the championship season, where a lot of our players play, ended a long, long time ago. So a number of these players are without games and getting into camp. There was, I think, an in-house game a couple of days ago as well. Vitally important to prepare for this game. And the game against Greece has somewhat gone under the radar because of the Champions League and the Man City treble. This is an absolutely massive game, Marie, for Stephen Kenny, for the group, and for where we are trying to take this journey under Kenny and what it is we're trying to do with regards to our playing style. So we can't underestimate this game. I think over the course of the next week, the game against Greece and the game against Gibraltar, if we're to be serious about the progress that we suspect and we hope that we've made, we need to be getting 6 points from this game. I know a lot of people will say that that is a huge expectation to have, but you know, we went in as third seeds. We need to finish as third seeds, and the results against Greece are going to be absolutely pivotal to Stephen Kenny's future.
Mark, you're probably the only one of us who can't see this through green glasses. So what chance do you give us?
I mean, I think that Greece are definitely improving than what they were a few years ago. Gus Poyet got them heading in the right direction. They've got some players that are playing at a high level now. To Tsimikas at Liverpool, for instance, Flakadimas, the goalkeeper at Benfica, has been earning rave reviews. I think it's a game, I would say, that you know, from an Irish point of view, just don't lose it. You know, obviously a win would be great, but I think a draw would be a step in the right direction. I think that you know, that would be I would say the first target. I think it's interesting, obviously, to base yourself in Turkey because from a climate point of view, it's going to be difficult, even though it's a late kickoff. You know, Greece in sort of June and the summertime is not really the time you want to be going to be playing them away from home. So I think it's quite a close game. I think that both teams actually are kind of improving and heading in the right direction. But from Irish point of view, these are the type of games where if you can win, I think that, you know, the supporters, or maybe those that are doubting whether Kenny's the right sort of man, will sort of be more on board if you can sort of take down a reasonable scalp. And I think that this is, you know, would be a very big win if you could get it. Obviously, that there's a clear favourite in the group, and it's going to be very difficult to win the group. So I would say, you know, just finish ahead of Greece, and that should be the first target.
So the advice is lower expectations, take the draw and go and beat your brother. Thank you, Mark Langdon. Paul Corrie, we'll be back to you in a short while, but we have a quick break to take.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. I'm delighted to say that we are joined by Gavin Noble, Ireland's chef de mission for Paris. Gavin, how are you?
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So, Gavin, before we get into what's coming up in the next few months, there's the European Games and the Olympics are not that far away either. For people who aren't aware, can you tell us what exactly the chef de mission does?
Well, that's a very good question. I do everything and a little bit of everything and anything at all. Basically, I am the project lead for the Olympic Games. So I do everything from policy to selection to reccing all the venues. I have a big team, of course. But at the end of the day, I guess it's someone. There's a project lead and it's me. And the project just happens to be the Olympic Games, which is really exciting.
I'm having a good giggle here, Mark, and my co-host. The chef, the mission, not... fairly self-explanatory. Do you, Marie?
I did say for people who don't know. I mean,
well, I thought you were inquiring for yourself.
Well, that's what I say when I am inquiring for myself.
I knew
it's
that
funny
too.
Title, to be fair. It's a funny one, to be fair.
Chef to keep, chef to mission, chef to mission.
No, but I just think of food. You know, that's, you say chef, I think food.
No, chief. Gavin, it is an interesting job, and when I was reading up on you this afternoon, like even the recce you've done for Paris, like our rowers won't be staying in the Olympic Village, things like that. It's all about preparation, and you're basically preparing for everyone.
Yeah, exactly that. And we've been preparing for Paris since I started work on Paris in 2021. So these things take a long time to plan. We start off with, you know, 700 people who have a chance of qualifying. We probably whittle it down to the 120, 130 best athletes in Ireland at that point in time. All of the time, of course, the sports are in operations themselves, going to Worlds and Europeans. We have a large database and we do a lot of tracking. My job is to make sure that when we get to games, we've left no stone unturned for every sport. And we treat every sport the same in terms of how we approach what we need to do to support the ambition that they do have, and it's performing at the very highest level.
Go on then, spill the beans. Who are the most needy? Who are not going to be happy with the flight you have them on? Don't like the bus, aren't happy with where they're staying, want different pillows.
The most needy person is me. I like everything to be perfect. Answer. And if everything's perfect for me, it should trickle down. But there's a very different games this year to what Tokyo was, for example. It's Paris, closest European neighbour. It's easier to go in and out. I can go to Paris for 3 days and get a lot more done. Every time I went to Tokyo, for example, it took a couple of weeks, you know. So it's a very different games. It's easier in one part, but then it's a little bit more complicated because people know the area and they've more specific needs, you know. And you mentioned rowing just there. We've similar for sailing. We just finished off our pre-games camp planning for athletics. So it's about, most of our sports now are really, really professional. And sometimes it's me to lead. Sometimes I'm just getting out of the way and letting them do their thing. But we're trying to bring the team. We're trying to bring 17, 18 sports as one team. And that's no mean feat. We're bringing all these different cultures together. So it's really exciting. But as you know yourself, it's a lot of work and it's a lot of planning. There's a lot of people involved.
Given just the pressure that comes with going to an Olympic Games, how beneficial is it that you have been there, done that yourself, that you can actually relate to what these athletes are going through?
Yeah, I think that's a string to my bow for sure. I understand not only from an athlete's point of view, but a family. And it's sometimes we see the athlete on the screen, but behind the athlete's performance is a mum and dad, a coach, a granddad, everyone from their community who's gone into supporting them get to where they're going to be. So I definitely have a real appreciation of the layers that go into it, and they're representing at that point everyone. I also was involved in coaching an athlete, Carolyn Hayes, in Tokyo, so I have a real understanding of the cold-faced coach on the ground. So I think I do have a broad experience, a good understanding, but I'm learning all the time. Like, I need to learn and not go into anything thinking I know it all. I'm constantly learning. I'm learning from some of the very best performance directors that we have. So it's really, really exciting for me. It's been exciting for me to be an athlete and to be now leading the team. So yeah, it's many, many layers, but I don't feel pressure. It's a real privilege to do what I do.
In 8 days' time, you'll have the European Games in Krakow. Are you looking at that as a trial run for Paris, in a sense?
Yeah, very much so. And the European Games in Krakow is a European Olympics in its own right. You know, if your listeners can sort of think of it like that, we've got 121 athletes, 17 different sports. We're trialing a lot of different things. We've got new staff. We're doing little things around the Crown Plaza Hotel in Blanchardstown, the Institute of Sport. We're trialing how we're going to set up our pre-camp, and our pre-camp for Paris is going to be in Dublin. So for the very first ever time, our main camp will be in Dublin for an Olympic Games, which in itself is really exciting. So there's a lot of opportunity for us, I think, for Poland, for Krakow, for us to learn how we're working internally, how we make everything a bit more efficient. And then for the games themselves, there's a lot of opportunity for boxing, for rugby, for a number of sports to directly qualify from there. So it's in its own right. It's high pressure enough for a number of sports. And again, you can link the games in Krakow and then in Paris on multiple different levels, you know.
Those pre-Olympic camps being held in Dublin, will any of those be open camps? Will you try to engage with the public and kind of send your athletes off with an understanding of what Olympians mean to Irish people?
Definitely. I think there's an onus on us to do that, and I think the sports and the athletes themselves will expect it to a degree. If we were going away to if we had booked the camp in Paris, we booked the camp in Fukuoka in Japan, and the athletes all met the locals, they met the public, the children. Like, part of our vision is to inspire the nation, so definitely we'll have open sessions. it's in Sport Ireland campus, and it's accessible to the public. It's not going to be a closed camp necessarily in terms of that venue. Will still be open as normal, but there'll just be exclusive hours for us. But definitely around the camp, and in the build up to the camp, we've got a lot of great sponsors making amazing plans for van zones, for all of that sort of stuff. So there's a lot of plans in the cooker, but that specific camp, there'll come a point where we have to shut it off, just the same as you would do before a big rugby match or whatever. But definitely the public will get to see their Irish heroes before we get to go.
At 500 days out, you did a piece with Ina Raiden of the Irish Times, and you said that we have 12 medal opportunities in Paris. That's talking now 500 days out, and I don't think that will change much, and that we shouldn't be afraid of talking about medals or finals. Is that something that you would subscribe to when you're around the athletes, or is it just yourself, I guess?
No, I think if you look at the results internationally, rowing, boxing, gymnastics, athletics, there are a number of athletes who, that's how they'll measure success, you know. Like, they'll measure success by if they medal, if they make a final, if they make a top 16. And I guess our role, the way I would look at it, is we try and do everything to create the opportunity that they can go and perform. And I think it's, you know, for your listeners, they might come up with 12 different answers. If I ask you right now, who's your 12? It might be a little bit different to mine. But I do think we have that amount of people who have a really good chance, and then they just have to take the chance. There's once the bell goes, once the starter's gun goes, there's nothing they can do to influence anybody else to a degree, and it's how they walk into the arena, and that's when our job ends, and that's when the athlete takes over the accountability for performance, you know. And you need a little bit of luck, for sure. Like, you need a luck to do anything in life, and you need a little bit of luck for sure to win an Olympic medal. But yeah, I'm firm in the statement that I think we've 12 opportunities to do very, very well.
Well, four of them will be show jumping team medals, so that's only eight required from everybody else. It's quite easy, isn't it?
It's a good game. It's a good game to do. Yeah, no, for sure. And we've golf, and we've got rugby. We've got rugby now. We've got boxing. We've swimmer who have a high potential. So I'm pretty good at my predictions, and I think hopefully of those 12, a high percentage of those will come back with some medal.
It might change even after the European Games as well, just given the way athletes can shine on the big stage at different times and all the rest. But there's some new sports in the European Games that I was hearing about that I didn't know were going to feature. One of them was e-sports, if I'm right, and was it kickboxing?
Yeah, kickboxing and paddle. There are two new sports within the sort of Team Ireland family. Esports is making its debut in terms of internationally part of the Olympic movement, and it's really, really interesting. They're not officially part of the team on this round. In the same way that some sports are sort of on showcase, esports is on showcase for these games, and they just announced actually Esport Ireland, a team of I think eight. To travel out, so I'm looking forward to catching up with them and seeing what it's all about. Kickboxing, for those who don't know, is a really prolific winner in Ireland on the international circuit, so we're expecting big things from them, and they're ready to rock. And then paddle, we met them today, you'll see a lot of stories come out about them in the next couple of weeks. It's a young sport, it's really fast growing. If you go to Spain on your holidays, if you go to Italy, you'll see how big it is. You flick on Sky Sports and it's the sport on TV, you know. So it's a young sport in Ireland, but again, this is opportunity for them to step into arena, to get a little bit of media coverage, to boost membership. And we've been working with them for the last couple of months, and it's been a pleasure. And again, another sport I'm looking forward to watching. And it's the good thing about my job is I get to see 17 different sports, and I get to learn 17 different times. So I'm sure I'll learn something from both kickboxing and paddle, and I might learn even a one or two things for gaming and esports that I'll be coming home looking for my Xbox that I've hidden away somewhere in the cupboard for a few years. So it's a great mix. It's really exciting.
Well, paddle, of course, is a cross between squash and tennis, which is a fascinating game, but I can imagine Paul Curry is the same opinion as me. Esports, Paul Curry.
Ah, stop. I knew that one would be great in you, Ruby. You're going home, getting the PlayStation out and doing a couple of hours.
Each to their own.
No dietary requirements say. There.
There is a space for everybody and everything, that's for sure. Gavin Noble, thank you so much for joining us. Looking forward to following you now over the next year, because I think once the European Games are over, then it'll really hit home that the Olympics are just around the corner and you're going to be so busy.
And the best of luck at the European Games.
Yeah, good busy. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, talk to you soon. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us though. Paul Curry is keeping an eye on the transfer news for us. We're going to be talking...
Hang on a minute, myself and Paul Curry are going to digest esports at the Olympics. That's where we actually need a break. That's where we have to take the break.
Yeah, you need that. Welcome back. We have a text in. Mbappe to Newcastle, Paul Curry.
You know what, Marie? I can see the logic between Paris and Madrid or Paris and London. But I tell you what, good luck to convincing Mbappe's entourage to go up to Newcastle.
Cold winter's night in Stoke. Cold winter's night in St. James's Park.
Remember, who was it? Was Nicholas Anelka was commuting by helicopter from Paris to Newcastle,
no
Paris
way.
To Bolton. That's about the only way that transfer deal go through.
Right, okay. Okay, we'll keep an eye on that. You never know if there's enough money in it. We're going to turn our attention to tennis now. Conor Nyland joins us on the line to talk about Novak Djokovic and how far he can go. He won Grand Slam number 23 over the weekend. Is there still more to come from him, Conor Nyland?
Hi, guys. Possibly, yeah. He could have 25 by September. He's broken the back of it, I suppose, in terms of getting out ahead of Nadal now, who's potentially got another appearance at Roland Garros, but probably won't be a contender next year. And obviously Federer's out of the picture, so he's going to be quite relaxed going into what's usually a kind of really successful period for him, the Wimbledon. Well, every period for him is successful, but he generally does really well, Wimbledon, US Open. So he's going to have a few days off. He'll, get the feed on some grass later this week, I'm sure, and have a nice 2 or 3 week lead into Wimbledon, and feel very relaxed and happy with what he's done so far this year. I have a real tilt to the calendar slam, which will be an incredible way to just underline where he is already.
That's all he's doing, is underlining, because of that generation, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, he's lasted the longest, he's won more than the others. He is going to, or maybe is he not? I think he is, cement himself as the greatest.
Yeah, hard to argue at this stage. Ruby, like, I know he's a year younger than Nadal. I think that maybe while a little bit of a, it was so almost a team effort in some ways to get the Djokovic to where he got to. Like, if there was no Federer, there was no Nadal, no Djokovic, and obviously Murray was part of the conversation for a few years. But yeah, if you look at it just as a metric of who's won the most Grand Slams. Obviously, Djokovic is out in front, but if you look at most Masters Series titles, he's out in front on that. He has most weeks at number one. He's the best in that category, and also year-end number ones at seven. So it's really, really, really hard to argue against him. And as I say, I don't think he's probably done yet. I think he could at least get to mid-20s, if not even high-20s, which is
probably
a scary thought.
To beat the women, Connor, as well.
Yeah, Serena 20, you know, and 24, the Margaret Court record. So yeah, just to get out in front and be undisputed. So yeah, an incredible thing he's putting together. I think Alcaraz could be a bit of a blocker for him. That was an interesting semi-final. Like, Alcaraz was incredible against Tsitsipas in the quarterfinals, and I thought he was going into it maybe a slight favourite, and then obviously his body let him down. He got cramping issues with all the nerves, I think, that have built up in terms of expectation. But he'll be tough to beat in a couple of these slams for Djokovic, but I do see him sneaking past him in at least one or two.
How does he get over the cramp? And I mean, he's blaming the expectation of playing against Djokovic. Now his body has let him down once mentally. How does he get over that to face him the next time?
Yeah, and he's actually had a few tournaments the last year or two where he's pulled out. He didn't play in Australia. He had an injury. So it is something, but it's also something that if you think all the way back to when Djokovic was Alcaraz's age, he had issues as well between the ages of, say, 18 and 21. There was nearly a bit of a running joke in the locker room. I remember Andy Roddick sort of saying he had about five different illnesses, you know, at the Australian Open. He turned it around. I think it is, like, Alcaraz is almost, he's nearly playing, his level is nearly ahead of his age, ahead of his body, I suppose, what that's capable of. He's so fast twitch, Alcaraz, he's so explosive that I think he is, he's really pushing himself when he's trying to win Grand Slams. He's only just turned 20 in May. So, yeah, it is a bit of a worry. Like, the cramping, I think it's more of a nerves thing than a physical thing. And I think when you're a bit younger, like you see it in Davis Cup, sometimes guys will cramp in a third set in their first best of five match, more because they know what's ahead of them than what's happened before. So it is something that you see in tennis. So I think he can probably work his way through that.
What about Medvedev?
Yeah, Medvedev he's in and out. I just don't see him at the level to consistently beat, say, a Djokovic and an Alcaraz over the next 18 months. He is obviously a Grand Slam winner. He's in the conversation. Clay has never been his best surface. So he's, I think at the US Open, we'll probably see the best of him again. He loves the American hard courts. So I think Medvedev is somebody who'll be back in the conversation. It'll be interesting to see if Nick Kyrgios can defend the points from his Wimbledon final last year. Been totally out of the picture for the last little while. But I think the grass brings up a few names. With it being such a novelty surface, they only play it a few weeks a year, so potentially he'll be back in the mix, which is always fun.
So finally, Connor, Wimbledon's around the corner. Novak has 7, Federer has 8. You fancy him to level it up?
Yeah, I do. I just think he's going to be, like, he's playing with house money. He's going to be so relaxed, even though he's going to be incredibly focused on winning it. I just think he's been in these situations so many times. Like, I find it very difficult to see him doing. I don't think Alcaraz has quite got the experience on grass under his belt this early in his career to really make a serious push. Tsitsipas is a little bit in and out, probably prefers the clay to the grass. So really hard to look past Djokovic in terms of the lead-in he's had with this win.
Novak all the way. Conor Nyland, thanks a million for taking our call. So we're going to switch attentions from one small ball to another one. This one is white, though, and it flies down a fairway. John McHenry is on the line. John, we'll start with the Canadian Open first, if you don't mind. Nick Taylor, 72-foot putt for eagle on the fourth playoff hole at your home Open. Does it get any better?
Well, he knew he was going to hold it, didn't he? I mean, my God, I mean, I think you're in a position like that and all you're saying to yourself is try and roll it up there, try and get it somewhere close to the hole that I can actually make a two-putt. And then it goes in and, I mean, absolute euphoria. And I think that, look, I think that Hadwick probably is a bit... probably bemused at what happened to him in terms of trying to get through to him from a celebration point of view. But look, it's a wonderful victory for him.
That's going to follow him around forever now.
Good rugby tackle,
it was.
It was a good one. Tommy Fleetwood, I suppose if you're going to lose, losing to a putt like that, does it make it any easier?
Look, I don't think it ever... I think these guys are operating at such an elite level that losing is never easy, because that's all they're playing for, really. They're playing for the victories and they're playing for the, I suppose, the prestige of that. Tommy Fleetwood hasn't won in America. You know, he needs to try and win in America. It's probably something he has got to get over. Tyrrell Hatton performing very, very well. You know, so, look, I think that... you know, if I was to look at the US Open coming up, I think the form of a lot of the European-based players is actually quite good. So, you know, hopefully we'll have a good week this week.
Yeah, and it's came upon us really quickly as well, maybe because there was so much drama at the Canadian Open at the weekend, but it is here and it is starting on Thursday. What's it going to take to win the US Open this year, do you think, John?
Well, I think the USGA have got a... I suppose, you know, typically you would look at a US Open golf course, it's very penal off the tee, very narrow fairways. But I think in recent years, the USGA have gone off script a little bit. I think this week, you're going to see a golf course that's set up a little bit more like Augusta National. A lot of elevation on the golf course. Players don't really like playing in a lot of elevation, very hard to judge balls. To elevated greens and very hard to, especially to hit shots into greens that are well below them. But I think a lot of room off the fairway. I think there'll be different strategies there. So it's not going to favour the likes of a Rory. But I think the person who can master the par threes, you know, quite uniquely, I think there's two par threes here this week that are the guts of 290 yards. So, I mean, I think that this course is going to play differently. You play the par threes well. You chip and putt around the green, you hit a lot of greens, I think then you're very, very competitive. And I think when we look at the Irish players, that type of a strategy probably doesn't favour Rory. You know, his greatest asset is his driver. Patrick will fear nobody because he's in bonus territory. Shane hasn't been putting very, very well, unfortunately. And really, Seamus Power is really looking for a top 10 finish and try and get a bit of momentum.
They're obviously all tee off at different times. Rory's playing at Brooks Koepka and Hideki Matsuyama. They're off at 9:54 p.m. John, a Los Angeles tournament is just a disaster for us. We're going to be up all night.
It's going to be a late one. But I think it's actually going to be a very exciting tournament because I think that, you know, the nature of the setup is going to bring a lot of players into contention. And I think that, as I said, I you know, look, I mean, you look at the likes of the very good wedge players. You're going to have a lot of wedge play. You're going to have a lot of putts. Then you're going to have a lot of holes that you're going to be, you know, really trying to figure out how to struggle through them. But I think that, you know, Justin Thomas would be someone there in that criteria. For me, Scotty Scheffler is the player of the season. I think that it's very hard to look past him. He's got great variety to his game. I think he's got a good strategy. His putter's been a little bit, I suppose, weak in the last couple of while, but he's still performing top five every week. And I think that he's going to be the player to beat. Rama's trying to look for some form. And I think that, you know, someone like Morikawa, who's performed very well, Schofield, who's performed very well under pressure. And I think probably if you look at I forget now who was it. He won the LA Open there recently as well. You know, I mean, I think that you know, these are the type of players who have performed well in the West Coast of America are players that you probably would be sort of saying, yeah, you know, Max Homa was the guy yeah. I was actually thinking of would certainly be a contender.
Los Angeles Country Club wasn't really putting itself out there to host tournaments for a long time. They did host the Walker Cup a while back, but a crowd of 22,000 per day, 14,000 of those limited to hospitality. This is going to be a slightly different US Open to the ones we've had recently.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I mean, when you bring the US Open into a private country club, I think you're very much operating on their terms and conditions if you're powerful enough like a Los Angeles Country Club. I think it's great. You know, I mean, the architect here hasn't built a huge amount of golf courses, but very, very, very well respected. And I think that, you know, this is going to be from a spectator's point of view and from a fan's point of view, it's going to be a different look golf course. It's going to resemble maybe Augusta, resemble some of the courses down in Australia. But I think that it really is going to be a very interesting challenge, because you can create loads of different strategies on this golf course, and every one of them is effective.
Well, John McHenry, you've done your best to make me stay up half the night, so thanks a million for taking our calls. I hope it's as enjoyable as you think it's going to be.
Too hot to sleep anyway, Ruby. Thanks, John. We'll talk to you soon.
Very hot in your house, Marie, is it?
It is, absolutely roasting. I'm not used to the heat at all. That's all we have time for. I'm going to go out and get a bit of sun now on the way home, go to watch one of those mini World Cups that are on at the moment. My little lads are playing, so...
I have to go to under-14 football training, so...
Right, Paul Curry, have you anything to go to?
I don't. My dinner.
Enjoy that, Paul. You deserved it.
Some esports.
Anyway. You right. Took the words right out of my mouth.
Benedict Silva is up next.
RTE 2FM.